Welcome to the World Heart Podcast. I'm Pablo Perel, Senior Science Advisor at the World Heart Federation. We are recording this episode as part of our May Hypertension series, as World Hypertension Day was on May 17. In the previous episode, we focused on salt, potassium-enriched salt with Professor Bruce Neal. And today, we are moving to very practical and central aspect of hypertension control, how we measure blood pressure, and how we deliver effective treatment at scale. To discuss these issues, we are delighted to have two global leaders in hypertension. Professor Alta Schutte, who is professor at University of New South Wales and the George Institute at Sydney, Australia. And Professor Doraira Prabhakar, who is executive director at the Center for Chronic Disease Control in India, and who is, for us very importantly, president-elect of the World Heart Federation. Alta, Prabhakar, we're very happy to have you on the podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Let's start with you, Alta, and blood pressure measurement. I mean, there's such a long story with how we measure blood pressure, and probably it's among the most common practice in medicine today. It looks quite simple. Why measuring blood pressure is still an important global health issue?
Yes, thank you, Pablo. That's a great question. I think we've had blood pressure measurements for more than a century now with a cuff. And it's been quite the same technique over many years, but now things seem to be changing with new technologies coming into place. I'll speak a bit on that too. But I think accurate blood pressure measurement is completely underestimated, and we need that for two main reasons. The first is to detect the millions of people with high blood pressure who do not know that they have high blood pressure. That's the one main reason why we need it. But the other one is also to have accurate readings that clinicians can trust. And I think that's been one of the big problems is there's so many aspects that can affect a blood pressure reading apart from the device and how the readings are being taken, the whole situation, that in the end, the blood pressure reading can be taken very quickly. And then the clinician do not trust the reading. And if they do not trust the reading, they do not act on it. And that's been one of the main challenges we had. I think Prabhakar will speak also on treatment. But treatment can only be done when you trust the reading that has been taken. And for that reason, I think the diagnosis and detection of high blood pressure is the main reason why we need accurate readings and also a reading in the practice that we can trust so there's action.
So if we try to, I mean, deep dive in some of the issues you mentioned, and we can think of problems that we might have with the device that we use, or the person who is doing, I mean, the measurement, and you mentioned a little bit about that, and also the setting where we are doing. I mean, what can you say, what are the challenges at each of those levels that we face now?
Let's start with the device. And I think there, the important thing is there are very specific specifications on what devices we should use now in practice. So for many years, people have still been using manual devices, aneroid and mercury and so on. But I think it's important to emphasize that they've been mainly phased out, and we recommend automated electronic devices that have been validated for accuracy. So the WHO have very good specifications there, and there's resources such as the website stridevp.org, which lists all those validated devices. I think if we can just get people to use those devices and mainly upper arm cuff devices, then we're all good. And they are quite affordable now. We have models that are not as expensive that can be used in clinics and are listed on the StrideVP website. So that's the main aspect, I think, in terms of the device. The instruction is clear. Yeah.
Can I ask you something about the devices? How big is the problem? I mean, in terms of, do we know, for example, what proportion of blood pressure measurements are done with devices that are not validated? I mean, is there any data on that?
There has been an analysis on the devices that's listed on Amazon to see which ones are actually validated for accuracy. And I think if I remember correct, it was about 1 in 5 only. So there are many cheap versions available. And unfortunately, the validated devices are often a bit more expensive than the cheaper versions that have not been tested for accuracy. The thing is, if they haven't been validated, doesn't mean they're not accurate. We don't know. That's the point. And often when they were tested, especially when it's from a very unknown brands, they are often completely off track. So that's why we strongly recommend that to stick with the validated ones, although they may be a bit more expensive. In terms of the setting, Of course, blood pressure can be taken in many settings. I think predominantly it's still taken in clinic, but although all guidelines now recommend confirmation of a diagnosis to not only be done in the clinic, but in out-of-office settings with ambulatory blood pressure monitoring or with home blood pressure monitoring, really important ways to engage patients. But we know in most settings, not even only in low and middle income countries, but also in high income countries, it's simply not implemented. It's very difficult in many. Some countries, for example, I know some countries in Europe and, for example, Japan, have a lot of people have home devices. So great for those areas. But in the setting, I think the problem that we have with clinic blood pressure is that it's only a snapshot, because blood pressure is truly very variable in any individual, right? It changes from every minute to minute. And it intra-individual blood pressure variability is between 10 and 14 millimeters of mercury. So the one point you could have a blood pressure of 130, and the next one it can be 144. So depending on how the readings are being taken, a diagnosis could be missed if you take only one reading. So the setting, clinic, is a challenge, although that is the dominant way of how it is measured. Whereas home and ambulatory measurements, I think, are much more valuable, mainly due to the fact that we have a larger volume of blood pressure readings. So you can actually capture that variability and work on a much more reliable average to make clinical decisions on. So I think that's the main aspects regarding the setting. Whereas the person, of course, when it's in a general practice or in a clinic, it is either the doctor or a nurse that takes the blood pressure. And the key thing there is that they are well trained on how to do it. The problem that we have is that doctors often don't have enough time to do a proper reading based on guidelines. I mean, it's almost always when I'm on those committees, I say it's not really realistic to take three readings in a clinic visit requires about 10 minutes. If you wait 5 minutes and wait a minute between each reading, often a clinic visit is less than 10 minutes. So that's why we are also in Australia, we are now advocating for what we call automated office blood pressure measurement. And that takes the blood pressure responsibility of the measurement away from the doctor. And we recommend training a nurse or anyone in the reception to take the blood pressure with an automated device where you press one button, you take three readings automatically, which is averaged, and you give that reading to the doctor to save the time in the clinic itself. So there are all these different scenarios that we're trying out to see what works better, but at least having a more trustworthy value of three readings that can be used for clinical decision making. Whereas for home blood pressure, that is the person is very different. There we have persons taking blood pressure themselves at home, and it's really an important way of engaging people with their own health. But if they're not trained well, again, how to do it correctly, and we know they are not trained well, we've done quite a lot of studies on that. If they don't receive any proper training, they start Googling or they just copy the doctor. That's what many do. And we know the doctors don't do it correctly in many instances. So that is the challenge of accurate home blood pressure measurements that should be accompanied with clear training.
Thank you, Aldana. I was going to ask you about, I mean, the role of non-physician on measurement, but actually, you answered that. And in a way, it looks like, I mean, today, if we really want to do it at scale, I mean, mostly it will be non-physicians measuring blood pressure. I mean, physicians will be the exception. But maybe what are the challenges? And I will come back to both of you in terms of key research questions at the end. But at the moment, maybe you can say some of the challenges we have with some of these measurements, maybe at home or by non-physicians or community health workers. Anything that you see now in the current context, some of the challenges with this approach.
There are several challenges in terms of task shifting or task sharing with non-physician healthcare providers. First is the terminology itself. When we say task shifting, people understand that we're taking away some of their entrenched tasks and giving it to others. And there is some amount of resistance and at times hostility towards this. Therefore, framing that terminology is important, and task sharing is a good terminology to use. Having said that it is a good terminology, it's useful. One thing that we need to be cognizant is what is the career path for these people, for the non-physician healthcare providers? throughout their lifetime? Are they going to remain at the same level? Are they, is there going to be career progression? Because it leads to frustration amongst these people in terms of what they're doing, and they lose interest and focus. So clearly we need innovative strategies in terms of utilizing them appropriately, adding on other tasks, or making it more attractive to them in terms of doing this. The third aspect is the challenge of communication between doctors and the non-physician healthcare providers, because in a hierarchical paradigm, it's going to cause problems. Therefore, a team-based approach is what is required. And we have to inculcate this habit of team-based approach. And actually, during the medical training itself, create this aspirational goal of having a team-based approach for management of any disease for that matter.
That's great. I think it can apply to many aspects on the role of task sharing, even beyond blood pressure measurement. But these are key points, and we'll come back to, I mean, some of the research we've done and other pending research questions. Just to finish maybe with some aspects of blood pressure measurement, Alta, I would like to ask you to, of course, one of the most, sexy questions on blood pressure measurement these days, and there is, a lot of hype. But I would like to really, you've been writing about this. That is about the use of wearables and catheters for blood pressure measurement. So there's a lot of expectation about this. What's the evidence so far, and are these technologies ready for clinical use now?
Yeah, that's a great question, Pablo. When you go to any hypertension conference, it's becoming one of the big sessions. People are really interested in the exciting developments there, and there are exciting developments. We just have to acknowledge it's a very, very different way from what we are used to taking blood pressure. So I think, notwithstanding all the different devices that's now already widely available, none of the global hypertension guidelines recommend using cuffless devices in clinical practice. Let's just make that 100% clear. And that is because there's not clear evidence yet on accuracy of these devices, as well as clinical usefulness. Both of these two aspects are extremely important. The thing is, of course, that these cuffless companies often, you know, they are frustrated with us not recommending their devices. They say they're widely available, they can already improve detection and so on, and that may be true. But at the same time, we require accurate measurements, and we require that these devices be able to accurately track changes in blood pressure. I think that's the key thing, because they're not snapshot devices. They measure it all the time when you wear them. And we haven't seen clear evidence that they can actually track blood pressure, for example, when you take blood pressure medication to detect the drop in blood pressure, or when you sleep. So once that is available, we will recommend them, because they will be, I think, widely accepted. But then we have to also think how they will be incorporated in clinical practice to make sure what sort of tools we can help GPs with when they prescribe, or when anybody else manages hypertension, how to deal with these thousands of measurements that the devices create.
And as you said, it's coming all the time, and it's almost unstoppable. But also, I mean, the speed or interest of companies doing this is different from what we have as a scientific community. So it's and the way of what they call, I don't know, getting approval, maybe it's not clinical validation. And I think one thing we always do, and I'll mention to our audience, we'll put some key papers that we include in the discussion. I know you publish some articles about this, and I think we can put at the bottom of the podcast, so the audience can. But I think it's a new field, no? I mean, we know the regulation of pharmacological treatment, but how we do with these devices? I don't know if it's a question, Alta, more of a comment I have, but maybe you have some reflection, or you, Prabhakar.
I can just mention, I think it has to be made very clear that when a device has received regulatory clearance by the FDA or any other body, it does not indicate that it's accurate. As we always say, they just confirm they won't kill you, but it doesn't mean the device is accurate. And that's where a lot of confusion has been so far. And for example, the Apple Watch, who now has a hypertension notification feature, doesn't give you actual values. That is quite valuable. Hundreds of millions of people already have those devices and can now be detected with high blood pressure. The sensitivity and specificity is a bit of a question because we've done a study where we found that if people have hypertension, in only 41%, the device would give them a confirmation, say, you may have hypertension. But in 59%, it wouldn't give you a notification, although you may have hypertension. So, it's a false negatives that's the problem. But the positives is good. If you think of millions of people, then you'll take that. So it's becoming quite pragmatic and gray zone.
So before moving into treatment and with Provaca, maybe just quickly, if you're speaking, let's say in a LMIC, maybe, I mean, you work in sub-Saharan Africa for some time, think about that context and you want to give a clear recommendation to a decision maker, to a health manager and a frontline provider on blood pressure measurement. What would be the key messages that you would give them now?
For me, I think the systems should be in place to ensure the procurement of accurate, validated devices and to ensure there's clear training on anybody who takes a blood pressure measurement, that it's done according to a simplified, clear strategy. I think if that can be implemented across the board, we have already been, we're already well along the way.
Thank you. And we'll come back to you, Alta, with some final questions. But let's move, I mean, to once there is, I mean, a diagnosis of hypertension, of course, I mean, we have still a lot of challenges and how we deliver care for people with hypertension, particularly in the context of low resource settings. So, Prabhakar, you work on many projects on delivery of care for hypertension and innovative ways of delivering. Can you first start saying what you think at the high level are the most important delivery approaches that we need to consider in these settings?
Thank you, Pablo. I think when you look at the care cascade of hypertension, there are many things that we have to consider, but let's consider three important things. First is the diagnosis, which Alta very elegantly said what can be done and what are the limitations and what are the challenges. Then comes the treatment aspect, and the third is, of course, the control aspect. How many people are controlled or treated to targets? That's the third aspect. So your question is, what are the challenges in terms of treating individuals once they are diagnosed? Overall, globally, there has been something called the rule of 50s. That means half of those who have hypertension are aware, half of those who are aware are treated, and half of those who are treated are controlled. But how true is this? This may be true in high-income countries, but when we come to low, middle-income and low-income countries or remote rural areas, it may be as low as 10% of the people are treated to targets. For example, in India, only 12% of the population is treated to targets. It's slightly higher in urban locations at 20% and lower in rural locations at 8%. So there's a long way to go in terms of treating people to targets. The second question that arises, how do we treat? Is it complex? Do we have to give multiple drugs to treat people? The answer to that is over a lot of research in the last 5 decades or so, in 50 years, we have now come to the conclusion about hypertension management is two things. Number one is that the initiation of treatment at the time of diagnosis should comprise of half doses of two drugs. And we have shown through research that irrespective of whatever you give, that half dose of two drugs is the best way to do, is basically because there is some synergistic effect. It also prevents side effects and has a better blood pressure control profile. So monotherapy now should be considered as no therapy, and therefore we need to start with two drugs. Whatever that is locally available, the generic drugs are good enough. The second thing is it has to be complemented by lifestyle advice that includes salt reduction, which you spoke earlier, increased physical activity, increased fruit and vegetable intake, reduced consumption of alcohol or no alcohol consumption. These are some of the complementary things along with the drug therapy. So this should actually be simple messages in terms of managing hypertension.
So, Prabhakar, going back to combination therapy, I know you just published recently a paper in India. Can you tell us a little bit about that trial you published in Nature? Again, we're going to put it below the podcast so all the audience can
So this
read it.
paper was published in Nature Medicine, and there were three PIs, Professor Neil Poulter from Imperial College, Dr. Ambuj Roy from All India Institute of Medical Sciences, New Delhi, and myself. The three of us devised this trial. The trial comprised of evaluation of three drug combination: an ACE inhibitor with a thiazide-like diuretic, a calcium channel blocker with a thiazide-like diuretic, and an ACE inhibitor with calcium channel blocker. The ACE inhibitor in this instance was perindopril, and the thiazide-like diuretic was indapamide, and the calcium channel blocker was amlodipine. So here we recruited around 2,000 patients. To give you the exact number, it was 1,981 patients from 32 centers across India. It was conducted over a period of 2 years. Essentially, we recruited patients, randomized them into three groups to receive any one of these single pill combinations. And at the end of 2 months, we up-titrated the drugs to their full doses if the blood pressure was more than 120 by 80. And there were two groups of people who were randomized into the trial. One was treatment naive, that they were coming for the first instance and they were not getting any treatment. Or the other would be people who were receiving one drug therapy and their blood pressure was not under control. We followed them up over a six-month period, and initial evaluation before at the time of randomization comprised of a 24-hour ambulatory BP, and at 6 months we did another 24-hour ambulatory BP, and our primary outcome was the change in mean systolic blood pressure of these ambulatory blood pressure, with a range of secondary outcomes, which included change in the mean diastolic blood pressure, changes in office systolic and diastolic blood pressure, and any adverse events that were seen. So adverse events were noted only in around 3% of the population. Most of them were minor. We didn't see a single patient with angioedema. Potassium levels, hypokalemia was the commonest, but nothing less than 3. It was mostly between 3 and 3.5. Just readjusting the dosage of the drugs or stopping the drugs catered to the problem. So there were no serious adverse effects. But more importantly, all the three drugs at the end of 6 months produced on an average a 15 millimeter mean reduction in ambulatory systolic blood pressure and a 30 millimeter reduction in office blood pressure. In terms of control, if you use the conventional criteria of less than 140 by 90, 70% of the people had blood pressure below 140 by 90. And if you use contemporary criteria of less than 130 by 80, 40% had less than 130 by 80. Now, just to put things in perspective, the WHO through its model data says, if we get 50% of the population with hypertension to less than 140 by 90, 46 million lives would be saved over a 10-year period from 2020 to 2030. That is the power of getting people under control. And what we demonstrated was a very simple yet effective way of controlling blood pressure.
It's a really nice read. I mean, congratulations to you and your team on that trial. And I think the message are quite clear. I mean, it's effective. I mean, regardless of the combination, it's safe. And also the level of hypertension control you achieve is great. But we've known, and maybe without research in India, but there have been studies and it's included in the WHO essential medicine list. It's now recommended in guidelines. What are the barriers for implementing combination therapy, Prabhakar? Which are the key barriers? You think they're mainly health systems about, I don't know, availability, or also there is some resistance from doctors?
So essentially, it is the fear of hypotension. That is the biggest fear which the physicians have, because they think giving two doses in the first instance is a very powerful sledgehammer approach. But the fact is, we did not have that kind of first dose hypotension phenomenon in our studies. In fact, it may be better than giving one single dose and then going up. The second issue is some fear of loss of autonomy, because doctors would like to start with a single drug and then step it up so that there is a better engagement with the patient, because here you're just giving them two drugs and then sending them off and coming back. So there is that fear, what would happen in the interim and so on. I think that is the biggest challenge. The second challenge, I think, may come from the industry, because the industry would like to come up with new drugs all the while. So that actually reduces their chances of bringing in new therapies, because many of these drugs, I believe, would be generic. would be off patent, and therefore that reduces I mean, it is at variance with their business model. I think that could be one second challenge.
Okay, thank you, Prabhakar. And I don't know, Alta, if of course, if you want to add anything to that.
I can just say I know about the Topspin trial. It was an excellent one showing also in India, but I think other trials on triple and dual combination therapies across the world show the same thing consistently. There is no increase in side effects. I think that the risk that doctors often see with dual and then later on with triple combinations is really not necessary. It's now to convince them. So I fully agree with everything Prabhakar said.
Again, with this one, I think, I mean, combination therapy should be the rule. I mean, now, and I think not only, I mean, probably moving forward with cardiovascular prevention in general, but we're getting to the end. But I want first, before going back to both of you in terms of research questions, I know one topic you work a lot, Prabhakar, in terms of delivery of care is digital health and technology for hypertension. I mean, and I know we can do a full podcast on that, probably, or more than one, Prabhakar, with all the work you've done. But maybe you can highlight some key concepts on how using digital health and technology can help hypertension care.
So digital health comprises of many aspects. Number one is the electronic decision support in terms of managing patients with hypertension, diabetes, or any other disease. That's number one. Number two, there is a AI component to this because earlier we were following what is called as a rule-based model. So we put in case studies in the back end, and based on that case studies, the machine learning algorithm within the system would identify what the patient needs and provide a personalized management plan. As we are seeing a rapid advancement in AI, we are now moving towards large language models and other types of AI, which can give you a better output in terms of how to manage these patients. So that's number one. Second problem that people are saying is that people are not digitally literate. How do we convince them to use? So my answer to that is patients actually don't require to be digitally literate to use this because it's being used by a non-physician. What we have done here is we have actually shifted this from the doctors to the non-physician healthcare providers because doctors are very reticent in terms of using any digital technology because it takes away from their time. And also they say that they can't focus on the art of medicine because it's too algorithmic. So you change it to give it to the non-physician healthcare provider who would do the measurement and give it to the doctors. So two specific challenges are the acceptance within the community, the doctors themselves not accepting the digital health tools. Two, the rapid change in technology that is happening. That is the second one. But I think central to all of this is the non-physician healthcare provider. Our review of non-physician systematic review published in Lancet Global Health a few years back shows that any type of non-physician healthcare provider are helpful in controlling blood pressure. The best, of course, comes with the pharmacist, followed by the nurse, followed by the dietitian, and followed by community health worker. So clearly, any one of them can reduce, but the best control comes with the pharmacist. But pairing them with digital tool is gets you even better control as compared to they doing it in the conventional manner.
Thank you. As I said, there are a lot of studies coming from your team and in India about this, and we'll put some of those papers in the podcast so the audience can read them. But just to finish with delivery of care, Prabhakar, if you were, and I'm sure you are advising, let's say, someone, a decision maker, and what's the minimum viable delivery package, let's say to a district health system, maybe let's say in India, to improve hypertension control quickly. What we know now, what would be your essential components?
So I think it has to be holistic. So number one is that we need non-personal policy interventions in terms of a healthy diet and reduced salt intake. That will actually reduce the blood. If you use simple non-personal policy intervention, it's estimated on an average we can reduce blood pressure around 10 to 11 millimeters of mercury. But at a population level, if we reduce the blood pressure by around 3-4 millimeters of mercury, we would have shifted the curve to the left and make a major change. The second thing is the biggest elephant in the room is air pollution in most parts of the world. And it has been shown that air pollution, a 25 milligram per cubic meter rise in PM2.5, increases population level blood pressure by an average of 3 millimeters. And I just mentioned that we need to reduce population level by three. So tackling air pollution is an important thing. And that's what I would tell the policymaker. Third is regulation of alcohol use can will be extremely helpful in terms of reducing blood pressure. In terms of population level control, screening and surveillance are very important, but screening and surveillance should be actually linked to a health system for treatment. And without that, screening and surveillance is not going to be of great help. So we need to link them to the health system. At the health level of the health system, treating them with very simple drugs, and therefore the need for a standardized treatment protocol across the country or across the world is very important, so that a standardized treatment is followed wherever it is required. The last area is patients coming back for a follow-up, and that's where many of them fall off. Even in the UK, where the treatments are free, at the end of 1 year, only 50% are taking the prescribed drugs. And therefore, we need mechanisms, we need innovations in terms of improving that follow-up and improving that access. And that is where a lot of work has now been focused. Telemedicine is an example, but delivery of the drugs to the patient through an innovative mechanism is one way of improving care.
That was great, Prabhakar. And I'm sure anyone listening, use those key messages if you're talking with decision makers wherever you are. I think it's very interesting, Prabhakar, that you're a cardiologist and, of course, you know a lot of hypertension, but you mentioned a lot of things that are more public health. How important is to have a population health approach to really tackle hypertension at scale. So it's, I mean, I can keep asking both of you a lot of questions of challenges and what we know, but we need to finish now. And I would like to move into key research questions that I'm sure you have plenty, each of you, and probably ongoing projects or proposals, but just give me maybe two key research questions, or one or two each of you, that we need now to improve hypertension control. Maybe let's start with you, Alta.
Yeah, we actually did a with the WHO. We did a research priority setting exercise. Had many conversations about this, somewhat aligned with what we found in those discussions. Is I think we need more research on system changes to allow for nurses and community health workers to not only measure blood pressure and work in the community to monitor, but actually also to prescribe and titrate safely. I think we need, I know many countries do not allow nurses and community health workers to do these actions, but we simply do not have enough doctors. And I think that sort of research questions is robust evidence is needed so we can actually get that system change.
Thank you. And again, this document from WHO will put it there as a link, the prioritization of research questions. Prabhakar?
So I think let us look at it at three levels, at the level of the individual, at the level of the health system, and at the level of the policy. At the level of the individual, one question that I think that needs urgent attention is how do we involve the families in terms of lifestyle modification for whether it is blood pressure control or in a broader sphere, any chronic disease for that matter. So that's how can we engage families and what are the kind of research questions that we need to pose for family-based interventions? That's at the individual level. I'm just going to, there are multiple, but I'm just going to give one example for each. At the level of the health system, there's lots of pilots that are going on in terms of using digital health, in terms of task shifting. The next question that needs to be asked is how do we widely implement this on scale? How do we involve the health system across various levels from the topmost bureaucrat to the lowest level of healthcare provider? And how do we engage all of them in implementing these successful pilots on scale? That's the second question at the level of the health system. At the policy level, we need to ask this question: how do we make our populations healthy? What are the taxations? What are the regulations that are required in terms of keeping the population healthy? How do we improve, for example, fruit and vegetable intake? Because there's a 50% loss of fruits and vegetables during storage, how do we improve the storage facilities? How do we promote kitchen gardens if we can do it? How do we influence people to use seasonal fruits and vegetables? What are the marketing techniques to improve low sodium salt intake? So there are several questions at the policy level that we can look at.
Thank you both. And many people say, well, with hypertension, we have known for so many years, we have the medication and we're doing, actually, it's a failure of the global cardiovascular community, the levels of hypertension control that you mentioned at the beginning. I mean, maybe 10% in some regions. And progress has been really slow. Are you more optimistic now? You think that there is a change on the pace of progression of hypertension control? Is there more at the global agenda, and you think there is a momentum for improving hypertension control?
What we have learned over the last several years is a public health approach to any of these diseases has a better yield compared to individualized approaches. Of course, individualized approaches are required, but with the understanding that public health approaches go a long way in tackling many of these diseases, I'm optimistic that we will be able to control. And second is, the cost of the medicines has come down tremendously with advances in technology. And with the advent of AI, I'm sure we'll be able to improve access to care to people. So all of these put together, I'm optimistic that by another 10, 15 years, we'll be able to show remarkable improvement in hypertension control.
Alta?
Yeah, if I can add to that, I agree with Prabhakar. I think it is, as you say, a failure that blood pressure control globally is about 20%, only one in five people. But I think, you know, the medicines that we have, dual combinations, are drugs that's already been available for many decades, some of them at least. So I think the fact that we now better understand dual combination and triple combination therapy, that's cheap, it's affordable, it's widely available, we actually have the tools. I think globally, there seems to be a shift. There seems to be an overall optimism. And I think we should catalyze that to make sure it reaches action, because we need simplified, high impact strategies that are affecting millions of people, 1.4 billion people who have high blood pressure. As Prabhakar say, for that, you cannot have precision medicine. So there's always this talk about precision medicine, which I have a lot of respect for the fantastic technology we have there. But if we want to improve the lives of millions of people, we need public health strategies. We need strategies that we can implement at volume to really reduce blood pressure on a population level. So hopefully we can do that. I think it's great to have these discussions, and hopefully it will encourage more people to join us to actually make a difference.
That's great. I think we share that optimism. And just to finish now, we always ask our guests this final question: what do we understand by global cardiovascular research? So that's just in one sentence, and there's no right or wrong answer, and probably we even change with time. So global cardiovascular research, maybe Alta, I'll start with you. What would you say is?
I would say it's working with colleagues across the globe, across all different settings to collectively improve blood pressure control.
Okay, thank you. Prabhakar?
Actually, you can look at it in many ways, but I would like to quote Professor Peter Piot, who was the former director of London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He gave a lecture in India once and spoke about global research, not cardiovascular specifically, but which applies to cardiovascular. So he uses the phraseology of computer software, 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, etc. He said global health 1.0 was the establishment of London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and Liverpool School of Medicine to cater to the diaspora of the British citizens who were in their colonies in many parts of the world. 2.0 was when the benefits of these, like, for example, the discovery of malaria or the tubercle bacillus was done in these, and it helped the countries which they were ruling at that time. 3.0 was the researchers from high-income countries or the Western countries going over to the so-called developing countries and working there and trying to give solutions to that population. But the contemporary global research or global cardiovascular research is predicated on true partnership. It has to be bidirectional. The benefits have to flow both from a high-income country to a low-income country and the innovations that are being carried out in the low-income countries should also benefit the high-income countries. So it has to be a true partnership, and it has to be bidirectional.
Excellent. And I'm sure there are a lot of things to learn from our audience, from wherever they are, high, middle, or low-income countries, from this really interesting discussion. Thank you. Thank you both very much. It has been really very interesting.
Thank you, Pablo.
Thank you very much.
To our listeners, we will link the key papers and resources in the podcast note. And thanks, as always, for listening to the World Heart Podcast.